So it's the 15th of May, and I'm in Chicago with Jonathan Baskin. And first of all, I wanted to thank you for agreeing to speak with me. But I had I'd like to get a kind of a grand overview of a few things, then maybe we'll dive into some philosophical questions. So in the grand overview sense, you're currently a graduate student finishing up at the University of Chicago, and but you've started this magazine. Could you talk a bit about how you came to be an editor of a magazine that's essentially your own?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I had worked in between college and coming to graduate school, I had worked in New York at a few different magazines doing things like fact-checking and copy editing, starting to do a little bit of freelance writing. When I was in, also in that time, I'd gotten acquainted with the guys who do N Plus One. And I remember going to their first party in New York, and, you know, at a time when everyone was saying, print journalism is dead, you're crazy to start a print magazine, and seeing 1,000 people in this lower school gym that they had rented out, or, you know, grammar school gym, and thinking, well, maybe it's not dead yet, you know, and seeing the kind of, just being interested in the kind of excitement they were able to generate from this print product that was publishing really serious intellectual writing, you know, to my mind. And so when I came to University of Chicago, and I was, myself and the two people who became my co-editors were classmates of mine, Johnny Thacker and Itai Zwick, and we were in this program, the Committee on Social Thought, which we loved. It's sort of a great books PhD program, and you sit and discuss the relevance of Plato and Hegel and Hannah Arendt to contemporary life, and, you know, and to your life, and I think that sort of ethos was so attractive to us, but we found that when we went to write about these topics, we were forced to do so, or we were encouraged to do so, in a way that was academic, you know, that was kind of didn't speak to the relevance they actually had for us. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the impetus behind deciding to, the reason I started with the New York thing is I think my experience there and seeing what N Plus One had done, I remember saying, like, well, maybe we should start a magazine where we can do the kind of writing that we want to do. It's not actually that complicated. Like, here's a model that we can follow to some degree.
Right.
That was sort of during that first year, during our second year, I guess, my second year in graduate school, we started having meetings every week and just thinking about what this thing could be and whether we could do it, and working toward putting out a first issue.
Mm-hmm. So, and yet you, I think the point is quintessentially not like N plus one. And I was wondering how you went about thinking about the character of the magazine when you were, I mean, how much of that was done in advance, how much of it emerged along the way? Does it have in your mind a particular shape or particular intellectual mission that sets it apart from other magazines?
I think it does, although I don't know that I could have said that confidently at the very beginning. One of the interesting things about doing this is you sort of find out whether you have a mission as you go. Yeah, I remember thinking, I hope this just doesn't seem like a worse version of these other magazines that I like, Harper's or N Plus One or whatever, you know. I was concerned about that because I wasn't sure we were going to be able to do it. But I actually remember around issue 2 or 3 thinking to myself, no, we really are different. Like, there definitely is something different going on here. There are a lot of differences, like, you know, well, there are a lot of things I could say about our magazine that I think distinguish us, but I guess the mission, I mean, it's the best way to start. I mean, there's this sort of University of Chicago great books idea, like, that I started with, this idea that great books speak directly to our lives and have something to say to help us think about challenges that we face, whether politically or culturally or personally, in a really direct way. And I think our magazine takes that idea seriously, in terms of its sort of intellectual, the way that it sort of conceives of intellectual life. I mean, I think in terms of this other thing to say about the mission is just this sort of Platonic idea of the good life, that one should always be asking what things are for and how they're related to our ideals about what the good is. I think is something that, like, you can see permeate the magazine in various different ways. In our symposiums, where we always ask what is something for, what is travel for, what is what is marriage for, but also in individual articles where we push our authors, I think, to think about whatever you're writing about, what is the value of it, what's at stake in it, and how does it speak to the values that sort of shape the decisions that we actually make. So I think that that's sort of the philosophical, there is that sort of Platonic philosophical mission that, I mean, I don't know if that sounds pretentious, but I think it does inform like what we do.
Well, and I think it's detectable, certainly. I mean, I think after reading into it, and especially through your, through some of the pieces that you listed as your favorites, I would have framed my own sense of what it is a bit differently, but and maybe I can throw out to you.
Yeah, how would you frame it? I'd be very interested.
and this is, you know, not having read absolutely everything. But it seems to me as though there are a number of themes that emerge in a lot of the pieces. One is a theme of kind of reciprocity, that there is a kind of reaching across into another realm, you know, and asking for something from something else or from someone else. And then there's a definite an interest in, like, touching ground, sort of like lingua franca initially. I don't think it's like lingua franca at all, but I would be curious to know how you would make the distinction between what lingua franca was and what the point is. Mm-hmm. Because one of the similarities that I see is that it's trying to connect, you know, the high with the world. But my sense of where the difference lies is that I think lingua franca was, you know, kind of the tacit view that that ideas are being produced in both, and that you have, and that ideas can move across those contexts. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think you know, and here's where I want to be corrected, refined, whatever. I think what the point does a lot is that it tries to touch reality in a kind of human, flesh and blood way. That it's actually trying to, like, that every piece sort of has a feeling that is intellectualized, and that it's the feeling that is the important endpoint, and there is intellectual work that's being done around that feeling, but that the feeling is, which is the point at which, you know, kind of like ideas meet flesh, is sort of the point, if you will.
Yeah, well, I like that idea about the flesh, because I was thinking that when you first brought up lingua franca. I do think, like, there's this sense, I mean, so the classic point essay, not all of our essays are like this, but the ones I think are, like, most indicative of what the point is, begins with a person having a problem, face or a feeling or a sense of something that they can't quite figure out. Yeah. And then, as you said, reaching toward some area of intellectual life or, you know, cultural life to try to find some kind of help with that problem. And I think, and then our best articles, I think they sort of go take the reader through that journey with the person, but also at the end come back to the person, to the personal flesh and blood problem or, you know, issue. How can I be a good parent? How should I eat? You know, who should I marry? And I think we do have a faith that, like, I sometimes think is almost seen as naive in a lot of, like, in a lot of intellectual magazines, that, like, these ideas really do go that far down. Yeah. Like, they go down to the most intimate, the most personal decisions that we make, and that these are all shaped, not always explicitly, and in some way that is what the magazine's trying to help make them more explicit, but they're all shaped by ideas or ideals. And I guess that's how this connects to the way that I describe the magazine, that, like, these ideals, philosophical ideals, guide even the smallest decisions, frameworks and, you know, ways of thinking guide, like, the smallest decisions that we make.
Well, and philosophical, yes, but I would also think, I mean, there's also a bit of ethical that I think runs through it. So it's not just philosophical more generally, but it strikes me as though there's an ethical underpinning. And here, you know, I was looking at your CV, and it's, you know, abbreviated but wonderful, because you talk about, like, all the philosophers that you've engaged with, and you mention Aristotle, Kant, Rousseau, Hegel, Heidegger, Wittgenstein, Plato, for example.
Yeah.
And there was one person that I thought I was hearing a lot of, or two actually, that you didn't actually list, and it was Levinas and Buber. They are both interested not just in the subject, but in the person on the other side of the subject. And, you know, the pieces that you sent me, there's always somehow some kind of sense of mutual responsibility between, like, one person and another, or somebody reaches something through another person, like Eckhart Tolle, or however you pronounce his name. Even though that seems like a completely solipsistic piece, he needs Tolle in order to, you know, like, withdraw, basically. Or in the piece on marriage, for example, or on the on Marxism and how they should be reading Marx. There's on conservatives and how they should be reading Marx. There's a sense that a reaching across needs to happen, that some other, that there's another side that has to be an interlocutor in order to get to this flesh and blood human stuff. And is there, like, is this by design or is that accidental?
Well, I think what you're getting at is like a theme I would call dialogue to some degree, idea of intellectual dialogue. And no, I don't think that's accidental. I mean, I think it is central to what we conceive of the point as doing. I mean, we don't, a negative thing that distinguishes us from a lot of magazines is we don't see ourselves as having like a political agenda. Mm-hmm. We're not pushing a specific view of the world. Mm-hmm. What we are pushing, I think, is in some sense exactly what you're talking about. The idea that reflection involves dialogue, involves really grappling with another thinker and seeing what they can give you, but also seeing how they challenge you,
But this isn't, I mean, as I read it, it's not a purely intellectual challenge, it's an ethical challenge that this, or in a lot of cases.
Well, I guess when you hear me talking about intellectual or philosophical, like, for me, the ethical is completely built into those things. I mean, when you talk about
people... It explains a lot.
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, when I talk about philosophy, I'm not talking about, like, analysis of language or whatever. I'm talking about, I mean, to me, people like Plato, and to me, people like Plato and Wittgenstein are extremely... I don't know if this is the right word, but dialogic philosophers. I mean, they write in such a way that they're constantly, even worked into their own work, there's dialogue going on with other voices. And I think that their work also calls to you as a reader in a way that's very, sort of asks you to take part in the conversation that they're having about things. So... Yeah, I mean, the ethical part of it to me is built in. If you don't see an ethical challenge in what you're... Yeah, it's not just an intellectual challenge. If you don't see that challenge as also being ethical, as speaking to your values, then you're missing, you're missing something.
It's interesting to hear you frame it that way because it naturalizes something that is not necessarily natural in a lot of academic
context. I guess
context.
That's true, yeah.
And so it's, it's so natural to you that you don't even feel like you have to, I love that. Maybe we could go back to some of the technical stuff and then we can return to philosophy because I have a tendency to pull in that direction a little too hard. Who taught you the most about what it takes to be a good editor?
That's a funny question. I don't really... I remember listening to Alex's interview and thinking he had these amazing... Well, I had these two amazing... Leon Wiesilter and who was the other... The woman...
What's her last name? I can't remember.
They were both like these incredible editors and he talked about their different styles. And I remember thinking about this question. I was thinking, I didn't work in any places like that. I really don't have... I really didn't have models... Mm-hmm. As for editing, I mean, I've been edited by a few people at different places. That was really. I was just recently at an article edited by Miriam Markowitz of The Nation, who actually I went to college with. and that I always learn a lot whenever my own work is edited because editors are so different from one another. I mean, the styles can be so different, and for me, it's always helpful to get editing from from somebody else, but there wasn't someone that like I watched do editing that really taught me. I mean, I really was kind of winging it when I started doing this.
What kind of editor would you like to be? Like if you, let's say if someone asked one of your writers, mm-hmm. Say, you know, like what kind of editor is he? And then you would get the ideal answer.
the ideal answer would be that he's careful. Mm-hmm. You know, he's respectful and thoughtful about what I've written. Mm-hmm. He pushes me to think about things I might not have thought about, but that are relevant to the piece. Mm-hmm. And I would say that he lets me write in my style. I mean, that he's, you know, lets me write in the style that the piece demands. Mm-hmm.
Do you detect any patterns in the way that you push or the way that you edit? Are there, you know, like things that where you can tell, oh, this piece has been edited by Batman?
I don't know. Well, so Johnny Thacker is one of the other editors of The Point. We have very different, I mean, we both do a lot of editing together, but we have very different styles. He's sort of more attentive to the intellectual coherence of the piece. He's a real philosopher. and he like really is zeroes in on sort of is there a confusion in the premises, or how does the sort of intellectual argument develop, and is it consistent? And I think that I'm more, I'm very focused on the tone and the sort of rhetorical, you know, progress of the piece, how it works rhetorically. Mm-hmm. You know, but in terms of, I mean, to be honest, I would hope there aren't. I would hope there are not markers of how you can tell I've edited an article. I would hope that, Because I really have edited very different kinds of writers, and I try to bring out what I take to be the best form of their writing. I guess the one thing I would say is I hope that the articles that I edit and that The Point publishes are not, we really try to avoid articles that we think just repeat what everyone already knows. Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, coming back to that theme of dialogue, we push a writer if we feel like this article is, it might make a good argument, but it's an argument all our readers already agree with. Mm-hmm. We really push them to consider what might be the opposing point of view, mm-hmm. and to actually grapple with it.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit about how you get pieces, how many of them you commission, how many of them come over the transom just to you unsolicited, or how do you acquire?
Yeah, so at the beginning it was mostly asking friends for favors. After we published a couple issues, we started getting more submissions. You know, most of them not good, but some good. And now, you know, we're able to pay, starting last year we began to be able to pay writers, which has made a big difference just in terms of, like, you know, we don't pay a ton, but it's not bad actually for Literary Magazine, and it's made me a lot more confident and had a lot more success being able to just see an article by someone I like in another magazine and go to them and say, hey, could you write something for us? Here's an idea, or do you have any ideas? And so we've been able to do more of that. Like in this issue, I'd say maybe out of probably 15 articles, maybe 2 were blind submissions. The rest are ones that we, you know, have developed, you know, with writers that we approached in some way, in some form or another.
Mm-hmm. And how, like, do you watch metrics for how, who's reading what, and does that, how does that figure into your calculations about solicitation?
You mean on our website?
Like, and can you tell which pieces are, I mean, presumably you can tell by one means or another, which pieces are really being read, and are those the ones that are also your favorites, or how important do you consider those metrics to be in terms of your decision making?
They're not very important. Well, they're important in one sense. I think, like, it can be a mistake to think that they're completely unimportant. I mean, obviously we want to be connecting with an audience. One measure of success of an article is that it finds readers. There's no question that, like, that is important to us. And I think that as a magazine in general, you know, if we're not connecting with readers, we're failing in some way, for sure. On the other hand, there are certainly articles that I'm very, that I know are excellent articles that never found a big audience. I mean, for instance, that the Charles Comey one that I sent you about marriage,
all right.
The Love We Use. I mean, it's on a topic, you know, it's a long article. It's a little bit hard. It doesn't sort of grab you necessarily at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And or it's not about a topic everyone's talking about necessarily. And, you know, that kind of article is not going to find the same kind of audience as, for instance, an article we're publishing in the next magazine about Ferguson.
Oh, right.
But I'm very proud. But I'm proud of it. It doesn't like diminish my feeling of how good of an article it was, and that it was the right thing. It was a good thing that we published it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, there are different metrics, but obviously, like, we love to have articles that are read a lot, and we do. Sometimes I'm surprised. I mean. Did I send you the Love and the Age of the Pickup Artist article?
No.
So that was an article we published in issue 2. It's a 13,000 word article about pickup artists and Stendhal, and it was written by someone I know. You know, I loved the article, but we thought it's too long to put online. No one will read it, you know, and we ended up putting it online, and it. By far the most popular article we ever had. I mean, it's something like 80,000 people have read it.
God.
I mean, it went completely, like, crazy. People went reading it. I mean, who knows how many of them finished it. But but it got a ton of pickup, and people wrote responses to it. You know, it was, you know, and it was on a topic. It was on a topic. I mean, in retrospect, I can see why it was popular. It is on a topic people are interested in, and it did a good job of kind of just taking people into a world that they... Right. We're interested in, but
so who do you imagine on the other side of the, you know, the page, if you will, like who's reading, or who, you know, like who do you imagine is reading, and then are you sometimes surprised by who's actually reading?
Well, I guess I don't always know who's actually reading,
right.
So it's hard to say. I mean, you know, as an editor, I mean, I imagine to some extent people like myself, or people like younger versions of myself. You know, maybe before I went to graduate school, but people that are interested in the, you know, curious about the world and reasonably well educated, but not necessarily have advanced degrees or whatever. Mm. You know, that, well, so I guess there are two questions, which is who I think is reading the magazine versus who I'd like to be reading the
right,
magazine,
yes.
Or whatever. You know, I think that obviously, like, it's easier for us to reach other academics. It's easier for us to sort of explain to them what we're doing and get them interested in it, or other people who read literary magazines.
Right.
Those are sort of the two ready-made groups that I'm pretty sure we hit more of than other groups. I think in theory, though, the point, like, actually, unlike some literary magazines, really has, in theory, a very wide audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not limited. I don't feel like we're, like, you have to be young to like what we're doing, or that you have to be, you know, we write about parenting and old age and, you know, marriage and things that are, I really think are like human things that people of all ages and, you know, as with a regular education, I hope can appreciate. I mean, and that's, I feel like our best articles should be able to reach, you know, a really wide audience, you know, people like my parents and their friends, and I want them to be relevant. I want at least some articles in each magazine to be relevant to that kind of audience. I don't know that we always succeed, but that's something that, you know, I sort of hope.
Do you think it's a relevance issue, or is it a technical issue about reaching them, about making them realize that, that it's relevant?
Well, no, exactly. I mean, I think that is the issue. That's what I'm saying, is I think in fact, like, our articles are relevant, or a lot of them are, to those people. But they don't know that.
And where would you see the problem? Like, where does the failure to connect with that potential audience take place, or not take place, as the case may be?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, we haven't done analysis of this or anything, so this is speaking completely, like, but, you know, the way articles get sort of consumed online today, it's mostly through social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, and if so, if the people, the way our articles get bounced around is on Twitter, on Facebook, and you're just not going to reach a lot of those people through that. You know, I mean, they're not they're either not on those things at all, or they're not on the same feeds that are bouncing around our material, you know. So I think, you know, for some of them, there's just a block. They just don't see, you know, they have their things they read. They have their reading habits. They read the New York Review of Books. They, you know,
right.
They're not looking for a small literary magazine to read. But
so could you go back a bit to the founding of The Point? Because you talked about its sort of intellectual inspiration. I'm interested in the kind of some of the technical aspects. Mm-hmm. So we all know what, you know, we have an image of what Silicon Valley startups are like. So there's
very
some kind
different.
Of, yes, well, and that's what, you know, using that as the sort of point of comparison. What's it like, or what was it like in technical terms?
Well, actually, I don't know if they're very different. There were some similarities. I mean, the three of us, basically, Itai and Johnny and I, sat and we met in Johnny's apartment in Hyde Park week after week, and we started thinking about what this magazine could be, you know, figuring out the name, figuring out what kind of articles we could get together for the first issue. I remember we had a discussion about whether we should give it away for free. Mm-hmm. Johnny and Ita said, no one's going to want to buy this. I said, well, I think we should charge something and see what happens. So, you know, and it really was for years really something we just used space around campus to sort of get together. And we, you know, we had interns come to Johnny's office that he had for because he was a coordinator for new students in our program, and we used that office to sort of double as the Point office. We hired University of Chicago interns to help with things like accounting, and but really the three of us, I mean, did everything. I mean, and we usually had a design intern also who helped with, you know, some of the visual stuff, which Itai is also very good at. But
so you would place a pretty high value on that interpersonal connection. I mean, how much, like, a true kind of exchange flow of ideas between the three of you, or how did it?
Oh, a huge amount, yeah. So, I mean, that was, I think, so much of the early part of the magazine, and this was something I loved and that we don't get to do as much of today, partly because Itai and Johnny are in New York, but was just us. We would meet on a weekend. Once we started actually getting articles in, we would meet on the weekends and literally go through every article, almost sentence by sentence, arguing, you know, bringing up objections, fighting, sometimes about it. It was especially bad when it was one of us who had written the article. Yeah, I mean, it was very much about the three. And, you know, at the beginning, you have to work things out because it turns out the three of you don't have the exact same image of what the magazine's going to be. Those are things that have to get worked out, again, like through the process and through the different, you know, there were cultural issues. I told you Johnny was from England, and he had a sort of different idea about what sort of literary writing was. And Itai is more political minded, and, you know, maybe further left than we were, and had a different idea of what the magazine could do politically. And it's just it was, you know, those things all get hashed out. It's stressful because it's something you all really care about, and you don't want to just give in. But you also want to respect the fact that there's three of you doing it, and it's a dialogue, and you're trying to figure out, like, what you know, what it's going to be. So it's funny how over the years those things sort of work themselves out. We don't sort of have those sort of fundamental conversations as much about, like, but even about articles in a way, you know, should we do this or not? It's like we kind of know now what we should do and not most of the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it definitely was a very much of a back and forth at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And do you get a kind of, I mean, it seems as though you anticipated at least getting a kind of an intellectual reality feel from the experience. Is that what it delivers?
What do you mean, intellectual reality?
Well, intellect meets reality, and that this becomes real when you have it in print, and then you can talk about these things yourself, and you can shape, you can sort of decide how reality meets print through what you curate, and I mean that. Well, or maybe I'm feeding too much. Maybe I'll ask it this way. So, what was it? You know, what was it that you were looking for in terms of, you know, like how the experience was supposed to be, and how does the actual experience of it match up to your expectations?
Well, I think, I mean, one thing I was, it's funny, like, I remember in graduate school, something that happens to a lot of people is around your second or third year. I loved my first year of graduate school, as did a lot of the people in my class, and then I saw some of them, you know, in the second and third year, they start to get kind of feel detached a bit from the world. What am I doing here? I'm on this campus. We're talking about ideas, but these, you know, you feel kind of detached from the things that are going on in the sort of outside of academia. And I think one thing I sort of thought the point might do this for me, but it really has done it, is like I feel more connected to the world outside of academia, I think, because of the point, because I'm constantly thinking about how to make ideas, how ideas are relevant beyond, you know, the seminar. And I think that, so I don't know if that's exactly what you're asking, but I think like that's definitely something that I had hoped to get from the experience and that I do feel like I've gotten from it.
Oh, that makes sense. So maybe you could narrate a couple of high, low points if you...
High, low points. Well, I mean, I remember actually, I mean, the first issue was a very stressful issue. I still think of a lot of the stories, I go back all the way to the first issue, but it's like, you know, that was a time when we were really struggling to figure out what kind of stuff we were going to publish. We were struggling to find material that we liked. We had the interpersonal. So I started to talk about this a little bit. But I mean, the interpersonal aspect has its dark side, and it can be, I think what was most surprising to a lot of us early on was how psychologically taxing and emotionally taxing the relationships are with writers, sometimes with each other, because we were all writing for the first issue, or Johnny and I did, Itai did for the second issue, and then getting feedback, and sometimes it wasn't what we'd hoped for, and there was a big editorial struggle actually over Johnny's article in the first issue. I think all of us had to learn how to take criticism to some degree, and also to give it, but also to take it. But I remember that first issue when we got Adam Bright's article, and actually it came very late. He'd been kind of working on it. We didn't know if we were going to get it in on time, and he sent it to us, and I remember thinking, wow, this is really like, this is the kind of thing I'm doing this to publish, you know? And not only, it was great, and I also felt like we could make it even better, given like what our background was and what kind of like, how we could help him talk about the more philosophical parts of it. And I really, that was a very gratifying experience, and then the article got selected to be in this, you know, was our first sort of award-winning article. It got to go in the Pushcart Prize, and you know, I think we were all pretty happy about that. And in general, the response to the first issue, I mean, the first issue, we sold out the initial print run, and that was definitely a time we were, that was great. I think in terms of the lows, I mean, there was definitely a time around issue maybe 6 and 7 when I think we felt like things were kind of stagnant. We still didn't, you know, you feel early on like you're sort of happy. Oh my God, it's so great. People want to buy this and that's exciting and you keep doing it. But it doesn't mean you've actually discovered an economic model to like really survive, you know? And we really were just kind of, I think we got to a point where the novelty had worn off a little bit and it was like, wow, this is a ton of work. And it's really, we also had other things going on in our lives. You know, Johnny was leaving Social Thought. Itai left actually. He has a real job now. I had some things happen in my life that complicated that, you know, how much time I had to give to the magazine. And it was just, there was a time when I think we all sort of felt like, is this worth it? Like, we're spending a huge amount of time on this. In the grand scheme of things, we really don't have that many readers. And it's hard to, and it was hard to see how we were going to kind of push things forward because the three of us just didn't have the time, really, to put in the work that we knew it would take to grow the magazine. And I remember after issue 7, we kind of came to a point where we thought, well, look, we either have to stop doing this or we have to find a way to expand, to bring someone else in that can help with the day-to-day operations of the magazine, to pay for improvements to the website, things that are just obviously we need to do. And that was, I don't know if you, so that was when we decided to do the Kickstarter campaign.
Okay.
It was sort of in a way like a last ditch, like let's see how this goes. And we ended up raising through that, and then through a big donation that came through from someone who had seen it, over $100,000.
Wow.
So that then changed everything for us. And that allowed us to hire Rachel, who's now been our managing editor for over a year and is fabulous. And, you know, sort of, and it's just allowed us to start investing in some infrastructure and actually getting the magazine out on time. And we've done that for the last year and a half. And so it's been exciting, you know, like trying to see how far we can take this and how, to what extent we can grow.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of noise in the background of all of this that you alluded to when you were talking about N+1, about the death of print and the death of ideas. Actually, I mean, we watched what happened to the New Republic, right? The backside and the entirety of it. And
did you see our campaign we did about that?
No.
Oh my God, the Rip TNR Books campaign.
Oh, no, God.
I'll show it to you. Yeah, we gave away a free issue to anyone who wrote in honor of the death of the New Republic Books last couple months ago.
Oh, I didn't see that. Yeah. But there, in short, there's been a kind of backdrop of decline in journalism in general and ideas journalism perhaps in particular. And from your perspective, how do you see the prospects in this area, or, you know, like if you had somebody who said, hey, I have an idea, I want to start a magazine, what would you tell them?
I'd say, I hope you love it, because it's not, you're not going to do it for the, you know, you don't do it because you want to make money or, you know, want to be a huge success. But I think that, I don't know, I mean, the whole thing about it, the idea stuff, I mean, I was really sad about what happened to the New Republic book section, because I particularly felt like that was a place that published things that really are unusual and are challenging to its readership and are depthful in an intellectual way that's very rare. I mean, there are a lot of things that go by the name of intellectual journalism that I wouldn't really mind if they disappeared tomorrow. And I think that, so I think it's like, you have to be careful when you talk about this area, it's like, what are the things that we really value and why do we value them? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not one of those people, like, I don't just think, like, reading is good or, like, it's good that there's serious journalism around. Like, it really depends what it's doing and, like, how it's challenging its readers and how it's, you know, yeah. So I think it's, like, I tend to take a more specific approach. It's like, what are the things, what are the things I can support? So I think, you know, if someone wants to start something, I think I'd say, why do you want to start it? Mm-hmm. What is your, like, what do you think is missing that you can provide? And if they have a good answer for that, then they should go ahead and try it.
Yeah, I mean, on some level, it's almost criminally easy because, you know, if you want to put something online, it's very simple. But on the other hand, it's all the more difficult because everybody can do that.
It's a total trap.
Yeah.
Because, it is incredibly easy. I remember, I think we were all shocked by how easy it was at the beginning. We put this article online, everyone reads it, it's great, they love us, you know. Anyway, we started a magazine, you know, it seems great. But then you get, like, you know, you get a little ways in, and then you start to think, well, it's taking that next step then that's so much harder to get to a place where you actually have a, you know, some kind of a organizational structure and, you know. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's been so impressive about what N+1 has achieved, because they actually have done that, developed another generation of editors and this kind of thing that real magazines do, you know, that's very hard. That's much harder than the initial thing.
What do you imagine for the Point's future, or what would you like to imagine?
I mean, what I would like is for us to become more influential and relevant in the culture, ultimately. I mean, that's on the content side. That's really the aspiration, ultimately, is to have more people paying attention to what we're saying and more people, you know, influenced by it and responding to it, thinking about it. That's really the aspiration. I mean, on the organizational side, as I just said, I mean, I would like to, I think, one thing we have not been good at is finding, bringing in other editors, on the content side. We've begun to find people now that have really helped us with sort of the more administrative and business side. But I'd like to bring, to develop more of a community of point editors also that are sort of, you know, becoming, growing into the roles that, that Johnny and I have now.
And do you see do you have what might be considered a kind of relationship with the University of Chicago, such that a lot of your people, I mean, it seems come out of the, or is that?
We don't have a formal relationship with them. I think that for sure the mood and ideas in the magazine reflect the University of Chicago to some degree, and certainly there's probably a decent percentage of our writers in every issue come from University of Chicago, just because that's where we're best known and people know us personally. And I think that the idea of the magazine resonates there. And I think whatever happens with us, we'll always have that spirit of the University of Chicago to some degree informing what we do. But whether we'll continue to have as close as, I mean, I'm probably in my last year there now. Rachel went there, though. So, I mean, even our younger staff has come from University of Chicago. So I think we'll remain connected to them in a lot of ways.
Maybe you could talk a bit about that in the scene. I mean, New York is such a... Yeah. It's so heavy. Yeah. You know, everything kind of sinks into it. I mean, two of your editors are there, right?
They're sinking right now.
So what is it like running an ideas magazine out of a place that isn't New York?
No, it's been very interesting. I mean, there's positives and minuses. I mean, I don't think I probably would have ever started this magazine in New York, or any of the three of us would. I think we just would have felt, there's enough of this, there's tons of people doing this, who's gonna, you know, it's too competitive, it's too expensive, all the things. I think that being here, being at University of Chicago, there was a real space, there felt like there was a real space, both an intellectual space and also a space in the market or in the culture or whatever, for this kind of thing. I mean, there really is, I mean, someone will probably get mad at me for this, but there really is nothing else like that's doing what we're doing in Chicago, anything close to what we're doing in Chicago. I mean, there are poetry journals and things like that, but in terms of like sort of essays like this, there's nowhere else based here that's doing that. And so I think that we saw that as an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we've also found out maybe why there's not somewhere else doing that. I mean, it is difficult. It's not in New York, there's this sort of ready-made audience for new magazines. And we felt it even when we have events there. There are tons of people who just come because we're a new magazine and they're interested in that. They want to know what's going on, you know? And or we're a magazine they haven't heard of and they want to know more. Here, you really have to kind of convince people. They don't care that you're in a new magazine. You kind of have to convince people, like, no, this is going to change your life. Like, here's, you have to read this because, you don't know how to parent without us. Or so, there's this almost like, you know, you really have to appeal to people in a more sort of direct way. That's difficult. I mean, and there's also not this kind of network of people that just are going to these publishing parties. And I think it's been a challenge. I mean, we probably still have like more subscribers in New York than we have in Chicago. I don't know, actually, it's close, but
where
I think
are your other centers? So Chicago, you have a center, presumably New York. Do you have other places that kind of stand out?
It's really Chicago and New York in terms of like, if you looked at our subscriber list, those, I mean, London, actually, we have a fair amount, partly because of Johnny and, although the shipping cut, soon we're going to have digital subscriptions, which we hope will help
yes.
with people in foreign countries. But it really is Chicago and New York are the places where most of our subscribers are.
Mm-hmm. Is there something that, I mean, have you noticed a change since you started in the intellectual environment around the magazine in Chicago? Is it always the same uphill battle?
It's still an uphill battle. I mean, definitely, you know, we're a little more well-known than we were years ago, but, you know, we haven't penetrated very far. In Hyde Park, I think, generally people know who we are. Mm-hmm. But, the thing about Chicago is like, Chicago is not a very intellectual city. It's just not. I grew up here. Like, it's, you know, and And Hyde Park is, of course, Hyde Park's one of the most intellectual neighborhoods in the country.
Right.
And so, again, there's a sort of natural interest in what we're doing there, whereas in the rest of the city, it's a harder sell.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about is one of the other patterns that I see in some of the pieces that you pulled out as among your favorites is that there's a lot of very personal engagement with ideas, and there's a comfort with writing from the perspective of the I, of introducing details from one's life and so on.
Yeah.
And I think you yourself, when you wrote in your piece on baseball, there's some I in there.
Yeah,
but there's no I in your piece on David Foster Wallace. And I'm wondering how, you know, like, where, when, how can you tell when the I belongs there and when it needs to be exiled? Or is that a conscious decision, or does it just happen?
That's
that
a
way?
Tough question. Yeah, I mean, it's funny to say there's no I in the David Foster Wallace piece, because in a sense, it's all I. I mean, I think that. That article was very personal for me, and it was very much, I mean, one of the reasons we started the magazine was I wanted to write that article, and I couldn't find a place for it, in a way, what I was trying to articulate in that article was that I felt like people had missed something. People that were writing about Wallace were missing something about why he was so important to people like me, basically, and people in my, and so I framed it in terms of my generation, we who came of age in the 90s, you know, but in a way I was trying to, and I think I usually try to do this in articles where I write about literature, I was trying to kind of define I was certainly trying to show like a very direct link, a very direct relationship between Wallace and his readers that is personal for me. But in a way, I guess I didn't feel like I needed to say I. It was almost like implied.
Did you feel like saying it explicitly would have compromised the argument? I mean, how does the I ever get in the way of the believability of the?
I don't think it would have compromised the argument. I mean, it depends how I did it. I mean, obviously, I think like. If you're trying to make an argument about a writer and his importance, saying, I think he's important, or here's the effect he had on me, is not necessarily that convincing, unless you can convince the reader that your voice is representative, that you speak for someone more than yourself.
And that's what I see you doing in the baseball piece, that, you know, like, it's sort of, I would give it a subtext, here's how I feel, here's the proof that other people feel the same way.
Well, the baseball piece for me, I mean, steroids is, and I think when I initially started, I'm not sure I had a personal element when I initially started writing the article, but steroids and the way steroids were talked about, in a lot of ways, what I felt was missing was a respect for the kinds of people who really were upset by this.
Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to say, look, I'm one of these people.
Right.
Like, this is not just something that, like, some, like, you know, academic argument about are steroids right or wrong. You know, this goes to the heart of, like, what we get from sports and what an individual who cares about sports, why they care about them, or how they're able to care about them. Yeah, I guess I felt like part of the task of that article was to show how this topic was personal.
For a lot of people.
Yeah, for a lot of people. But I guess I did take... I mean, I think when you write personally, yeah, in an essay like that, you always take the risk. Someone might read it and just say, well, I don't feel that way. And that's always a risk. That can happen. Some readers will do that.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the task is to somehow, obviously, you know, if you're going to do that, to be able to write it in such a way that people do identify, or at least identify that you're speaking for a demographic that's larger than yourself.
Right.
But I do think, yeah, that personal voice is something we definitely encourage on The Point in general. I mean, I think it's related to what you said at the beginning, the idea of the sort of flesh and blood. I think it helps... show what the flesh and blood significance of these topics are a lot of the time when you have a person describing the importance of them to them.
Yeah, and I mean, along those lines, another feature that I think I see running through a lot of the pieces is that you're not shy about either yourselves or pushing other people to make an affirmative claim rather than just a deconstructive one.
Yes.
And that must be tricky for all of the reasons that that you lay out in the piece on David Foster Wallace, for example, the cynicism and what non-cynicism means or how it reads as. I'm thinking of the piece on why conservatives should read Marx, and whenever you insert something that has an affirmative sense, it comes off as either naive or conservative or whatever.
Yeah.
And so how do you navigate in a world that just doesn't do affirmative
affirmation. No, I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, I don't know if I would have put it that way, but that's very, very important to us, is that people feel the affirmative in our articles. We don't, I mean, to us, like, if you can't see, like, yeah, I'm trying to think how to describe, I mean, examples about affirmation. I mean, you know, something like Charlie's article about marriage is a very...
That's super affirmative.
Yeah, and I mean, you wouldn't see that in many magazines.
Or the Tola piece is totally affirmative. Or, the one about Marxism and about, you know, like, saying something that sounds really conservative and trying to recast it politically as, you know, as an affirmative move. Or, I mean, your piece on baseball, I think that's like... Or David Foster Wallace, for that matter.
Yeah.
There's an affirmative edge in both of those pieces that I think I detect. Anyway.
No, for sure. I mean, I think something that is different from us with a lot of other literary magazines or small magazines that are in our space is we are not, one of our core influences is not critical theory. And in fact, I'd say it's a reaction against a lot of what we see as our sort of guiding ethos is in some sense a reaction against both the rhetoric, mm-hmm. well, especially the rhetoric of critical theory, the sort of rhetorical moves that are so common in critical theory, mm-hmm. And then also in more complicated ways some of their political expectations or whatever, or some political assumptions. But I think that on the rhetorical level, it is just this privileging of unmasking and deconstructing over affirmation as if affirmation is always naive, is always, and it is, I think you're right, it's harder to be affirmative than it is to be critical. And that's exactly why we value it. Like, it is hard, and sometimes we do have to help our writers, look, you're going to come off naive if you don't consider this or if you say this. I mean, we do have to do that sometimes with our writers, but much more often is the opposite problem, because we work with a lot of academics and they are used to destroying things. That's what they do. You know, they tell you why something that other people like is stupid or is corrupted, is indicative of class structures, is, you know, whatever. And that's not a critical move that's very interesting to us. I mean, or at least there are plenty of other people that are doing that. That's not what we're interested in doing.
Mm-hmm. The one exception I can think of, and I think it's an exception, but maybe you can correct me, is the piece on Cloudgate, which I think, you know, you don't really know where it's going until
the end.
Until nearly the end. And it's sort of, it's very powerful, though.
Yeah.
Would you make an argument for it being affirmative?
Well, I think that is a piece, you're right, that the conclusion it comes to has a kind of critical theory twist to it at the end. But I think that the reason that I love Jacob's writing so much in that article, you see it, is that he first really gets you invested in the experience of being in the presence of these artworks, and shows you like what. So I mean, I think it's not like we're opposed to someone having a critical, you know, having a criticism of something, of an artwork, of a novel, of a person, of a politician. But I think it's like it's not that interesting to us unless you can first really appreciate what's, and not just what's good about it for other people, but what you yourself see as good about it or have experienced as good about it, you know?
Yeah.
It's so the typical critical move is, well, here all these people like this thing. They like it for this reason. And now I'm going to tell you why that reason is not, you know, is somehow, you know, wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if someone's going to criticize something for us, we're only interested in it if they can first tell us what they thought was good in it, that they've gone on the journey of seeing what was good before they've kind of, you know.
Yeah. Well, and this is sort of how, you know, I think your piece in The Nation on Ben Lerner is instructive in this regard. Because it's devastating and yet it's affirmative at the same time. Because by you know, kind of taking down, it elevates an alternative, or so it seems. And I wouldn't have necessarily thought that possible. But because the subject is such a deconstructivist, or you know, is so much in this zeitgeist constant self-reflection that can never kind of get out of itself. And so I wanted to play one language game with you. A Wittgensteinian language game. And so I'm going to give you a question. And the question is Ben Lerner a fraud?
No.
Explain.
See you. Well,
this is like,
I think that fraudulence is a, I think that he would probably say he was a fraud.
In fact, he would be fraudulent.
His narrators call themselves frauds constantly. Mm-hmm. It's not that he would be fraudulently saying it. I just think he wouldn't know what he was saying. Mm-hmm. It's actually like I think it's a boring category. Mm. We're all frauds in some sense. We all do things that are artificial, that are, I don't know, you know, have you ever read David Foster Wallace's story, Good Old Neon?
No.
He writes very eloquently about this topic in that story. And he was another novelist who was very concerned with fraudulence, but I think in a slightly more interesting way than Ben Lerner is. But in any event, yeah, no. I wouldn't know what I was saying by calling him a fraud. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be my answer. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think that category really like does the work that a lot of people think it does. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some artificiality in all of us. We all do things self-consciously. We all do things, you know, that are none of us act spontaneously all the time, or never do things that are manipulative in some way. And so there's this whole terrain within the topic that I think is like, we need better words for talking about.
Mm-hmm. I like that you mentioned that use the phrase better words. It's almost as though it's not just better words. It's sort of like the language itself has to be kind of either scrubbed or...
Well, it's the fraudulence and authenticity. This binary has become like such a trap, I think. And particularly in American literature, for American writers, for whatever reason, it's become like an obsession, you know? And part of what prompted me to write that article about Lerner was, and it was something I was very interested in when I was younger. I mean, some of my attraction to Wallace and the writers I was into when I was younger had to do, I thought this was a very interesting topic. I ask myself all the time, am I fraudulent? Or, you know, and it was when I was reading Lerner, I just had this feeling like, this is so boring. I can't believe we're still talking about this. And like, that sort of went in a way, like prompt, you know, was the impetus behind me then trying to think, well, why do I feel that way? This is something that used to really interest me. Why am I sort of not interested in it anymore? And trying to think about that was part of the point behind the article, mm-hmm. part of the motivation for the article.
Is there a kind of new frontier that you've noticed in language where certain elements of language are getting stale? So this, I think you did a nice job of pointing it out in the case of Ben Lerner, you know, the false binaries, the constant self-reflexivity, the sort of modernist bind that, you know, kind of winds itself up into kind of like no exit.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there's some other frontier that you see kind of coming up on the horizon that's spooky because it's a language that was, again, dear to you at some time, mm-hmm. or whether, because you've been editing The Point for a long time. Are there some elements of the language that was that you used or that your authors used early on that have since, like, that they just don't work anymore in the way that they did, or...
Well, I don't know. I'm starting to see the word affect show up a lot. I don't know if this is... I mean, it's really actually unbelievable. Like, in the last year, the amount of articles that we get that talk about... I mean, either use it casually or make it a sort of central topic. Mm-hmm. And I'm very... I mean, it's clearly not... That word clearly isn't dead yet. I mean, it's maybe still on the rise, but... That's a whole complex of language, a whole language that's, again, coming out of... people keep saying English departments are dead, but they keep generating new words that we have to deal with then until everyone gets tired of them.
How do you deal with them? I mean, do you excise and you know, force people to use different language, or...?
Well, I think it's always, like, are they using the word in a way that is... jargon or not. Mm-hmm. Jargon can come in so many different ways, but, like, are they using it in, like, is it in place of real thought, or is it actually expressing something that a reader who's not an expert in affect theory, for instance, can identify with and understand? So it's not like I banish the word. In fact, the article on Ferguson that I was talking about uses it, and I think uses it well, and talks about the affective dimension of political protest, and, you know, I think it's obvious what he's talking about, but I am sort of on the lookout for times when it just all of a sudden pops up, you know, in these kind of, you know, and it's like become this, like, obligatory, you know, thing that people are talking about now. So I think it's really a case by case basis. I mean, I've never been said, you know, no to a word, you know, any word can be used in a way that's helpful, but you do start to see it's more about words being used habitually instead of thoughtfully.
Right. Yeah. So, could you talk a bit about how the writer that is you relates to the editor that is you?
The writer that is me. I think that, I can talk about how editing has influenced my writing to some extent.
Yeah. That would be great.
I think there's one thing that's scary about editing for your own writing, which is you sort of realize how little the writer is capable of seeing his own tics, habits, shortcomings, and it's true of every writer, basically. And so you know it must be true of yourself as well. And you hope that through editing you'll be able to recognize those things more with yourself, but I find that still, I hand it into someone else and they tell me, well, you use the same sentence structure 22 times, and, you know, and I think, oh my God, I do the same thing that these other writers. So in some ways it creates humility, I think, in a good way. Like you know that there's a part of this process that is dialogical, and getting feedback is so important. And I think it's helped me in my ability to take feedback and be productive with it, because I don't know, the amount of interactions I've had with writers and seeing why it doesn't work when they don't take the feedback. And the right, sometimes they take it too much to heart, sometimes they reject things, they get defensive. I mean, there's so many different ways you can kind of refuse the help that the editor's trying to give you. And then there are ways that you can let it help you. And I think that I've probably gotten better at doing that as a writer.
So we talked a bit about this kind of dialogical approach that comes through in a lot of the pieces that you publish, and, you know, ones that you write as well. So is there a dialogical relationship? I mean, does that carry over into the way you conceive of the relationship between writer and editor? I mean, what is the nature of that relationship? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I think so. I think when it's at its best, it is a dialogue. You know, you don't want to be too. I mean, the writer is the one who's in control of the dialogue. You're the interlocutor. You know, you're. I think you don't want to mistake yourself for being the primary you know, the person who started the conversation, the writer started the conversation, and he's going to end it. But you have, in the process of the conversation, I think, as an editor, a chance to hopefully push him to places that he might not have gone otherwise. I think those are the best editing experiences. I mean, of course, there's a lot of prosaic stuff just dealing with, you know, arguing over commas and whether this should be the topic sentence or whatever. But I think the most interesting part of it to me and the deepest part has to do with that conversation about the ideas in the piece and about, you know, really pushing the writer. And so often you sometimes just pushing out of what seems like a very superficial thing will get you to that. You'll very quickly all of a sudden realize, oh my, I have a different idea of the piece than he does. And here's where I thought it was going. And then he gets to explain where he thought it was going. And I think that can just be such a productive conversation for a piece of writing, mm-hmm. and thinking in general.
So is there an editorial high to be had?
Yeah, I think there is. When you read through that article and for the first time you just feel like it works, especially if it's been a particularly thorny experience where you've been moving things around and arguing about things, I think that's definitely a high. I always feel excited about that, and I feel excited especially when I see that it's going to connect. That it's going to, because it connects with me, I know it will connect with the readers, you know, and that is always an exciting feeling.
What do you think it would take to get better at editing?
Probably just editing.
Yeah, there's that.
I mean, look, I'm sure, like I said, I learn every time I write something, I learn from the editors that I work with, and I'm sure, like, the experience that Alex talked about, seeing other editors do what they do, I think would be extremely valuable too. So, I mean, I would say I just happen not to have really had it, but I would have loved, I mean, I think that being around other editors and seeing how they do what they do is great. It's no substitute for doing it yourself. I mean, ultimately, like, just like most things, you learn the most once you start actually doing it. Mm-hmm. I definitely think, I mean, I think all of us on the magazine have, you know, now doing it for 5 years, like, we've certainly gotten better than how we were at the beginning.
How do you deal with the invisibility aspect? I mean, the fact that you put a lot of work into these things, and then it's the writer's name that goes on it, and a lot of your work is completely invisible.
Yeah, I don't know. It's never bothered me. I guess I feel, I don't know. I know that I did it. I mean, I know what I did to help the article, you know, be what it is. And I think that, you know, the people that are around the magazine know, the other editors, and I think maybe if I was doing this alone, it would bother me more. But something, even just having a couple other people, the team aspect of it, you sort of feel this sense of shared achievement, I think, when you've brought an article along and gotten it to the place where you're really satisfied with it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that's always been really satisfying to me. I've never felt like, I've never felt like, oh, I wish this person, the readers, knew how much I had to do with this article. I don't know, it just doesn't. I mean, I think when you're running a small magazine, too, it's probably different because, like, if you're working at, like, if you're an editor at, like, The Nation or you're an editor at, like, some bigger place, it's like you really are more invisible. Like, people might have no idea who you even are. Mm-hmm. With The Point, like, anytime someone likes something in The Point, like, I feel it's ours, you know? Like I feel like some of that is about me. So it's never been an issue of, like, you know, I just feel proud of the article that we published it, you know?
Well, you listened to the interview with Alex Starr, and he, I don't know if you remember the place where he talked about how he was, like, nostalgic periodically for the times when, you know, it was a new magazine, they were just starting it up. Yeah, and I mean, when you listen to that part, like, did you think, yes, I'm having that experience now?
Oh, for sure. Well, I thought, I mean, yeah, I mean, we're not exactly at the start, but we're still obviously very small, and yeah, for sure. I don't totally know what he's talking about. I mean, it's exhausting, but it's a lot of fun, you know? And yeah, that sort of team feeling. I mean, I've never done book editing like he's doing now, and he was contrasting it with that. Yeah. But For sure. I definitely identify with that. I think that's, in that way, it probably is similar to the startup thing, like you talked about in Silicon Valley or whatever. There is just that team feeling of achievement every time you get, I mean, to get this magazine out, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe we did it again. You know? It seems like not very much, twice a year. I mean, it's nothing. There are magazines that come out every week, but somehow it feels like this incredible achievement to get it out.
It is. I mean, it's a Herculean effort.
Because you know what's gone into it.
Yes. Well, on that note, I think we'll thank you very much for talking with me about these things, and I wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you.